I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 2nd, 2023. We do have a quorum present. So the first item on the agenda will be approval of the minutes. Representative Finke, do I have a motion to approve the minutes of January 31st?
So moved.
All right. The minutes are before us. Any discussion to the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. First bill on the agenda today is Representative Greenman bill. I will move that House File 36 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Greenman, I understand you have an amendment and an oral amendment. Okay, so I will have you, so I'm going to move the 36 A1 amendment in front of us. And then if you can explain that amendment and then the oral amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
As well as you can.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. The A3 amendment was drafted to incorporate feedback from the retailers and other stakeholders. It includes two changes. First, language to clarify that this policy applies to warehouse, to folks doing warehouse work, does not include the quota requirements. Or notice requirements don't include other employees that may be administrative, manufacturing, sales and accounting. And then the second piece raises the threshold of the warehouses covered from 100 workers to 250 workers. That's the A3.
I believe it's actually the A1.
Oh, A1. Thank you.
So to clarify, what's before us right now is the A1 amendment, which is separate from your oral amendment, to clarify. So the A1 amendment is what you just described as raising the number of employees. So to get this in the shape that you want, we'll move this. All those in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted, and then move on to explain your oral amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment was actually brought to me from House Research, page 4, line 10, delete injury and insert quote, the violation. It makes it consistent with the rest of the provisions. And I could turn it to Nathan Hopkins to explain the oral amendment.
I think we have a guest House Research member here who I think is here for this reason. Marta, if you want to.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
What that amendment is.
Yes. Marta James from House Research. So, yes, as Representative Greenman said, it is a technical amendment. Within that section, it refers to the violation, and so this language is just consistent at page 4, line 10, to make it consistent to say the violation instead of injury.
All right. Thank you. Any discussion to that oral amendment? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Right. The motion prevails, and both amendments are now adopted. Representative Greenman, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, House File 36 as amended is a bill that protects warehouse worker safety here in Minnesota with a common sense requirement that big warehouse companies notify their workers of any quotas they're expected to meet and provides those workers with access to their data and how they're performing these quotas. I know the purview of this bill in this committee is Subdivision 6 related to the civil enforcement provision. I'm largely going to keep my comments to that, but I will give a brief explainer of the bill and sort of where its origins. You know, all Minnesota workers deserve to be safe and respected at work, and that is not the experience we've been hearing the last couple of years at big warehouses like Amazon warehouses in Minnesota. We have heard the experience directly from workers. We heard this in labor. We've heard this last year. Some of you may have heard this bill last year. Workers being forced to work at a grueling pace under intense surveillance and the threat of discipline. Workers are pushed to pushing themselves to the brink and time off task measures that are constantly changing and often not disclosed to workers. They don't have enough time to take breaks, to eat or use the bathroom, prayer breaks, because of this relentless pace and the size of the warehouses. This has led to an injury rate documented in research that's 1.5 times the injury rate of non-Amazon warehouses in Minnesota and 3 times the injury rate of private industries. It's led to a workforce turnover rate of 170% over other Minnesota warehouses. So for members who heard this last session, or maybe you were in labor, there are powerful stories of Amazon warehouse workers, some of whom are here today, who are pleading with us to act to protect their health and their safety. A year later, a year after we heard this and actually passed it in a bipartisan manner off the House floor last year, we're getting new data and actually seeing that the problem is worse. Injuries have actually risen 10% from the already staggeringly high injury rates. This bill is a modest and common sense response to a big worker safety issue. It simply requires warehouse companies to notify their workers of any quotas. They'll be disciplined or fired if they fail to meet, and then allows those workers to request access to that performance data. It protects workers' existing legal rights to ensure all quotas and performance standards won't interfere with workers' legal rights to take a break, to take meals, to go to the restroom, and to pray. It gives the Department of Labor and Industry the ability to enforce these provisions, and relevant to this committee, it ensures that workers have the power to enforce these provisions themselves. Subdivision 6 provides a civil cause of action similar to the civil cause of action that exists in Minnesota OSHA and wage and hour laws currently in Minnesota law. It ensures that workers have the tools to enforce their rights under this provision and that workers will have the information they need to keep themselves and their coworkers safe. In the interest of time, we had in labor, we had about 10 workers testify. We have some workers here if you want to talk to them, but I'm keeping it short, and so we're going to keep it to my testimony today.
All right. Thank you, Representative Greenman. We did have one member of the public who has signed up to testify, so I will call up Bruce Newstead. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Newstead. I'm with the Minnesota Retailers Association. We're a collection of about 1,200 storefronts across Minnesota. About a third of our members are small, family-owned Main Street retailers. About a third are what we call regional retailers. About a third are national retailers. All those members actually have one thing in common. Somewhere in the supply chain or the logistics chain, warehouses are involved in getting products to their stores and eventually out to the customer. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today on House File 36. We've appreciated the opportunity to work with Representative Greenman and talk with the advocates in the past on this bill, and we hope to continue to discuss it and highlight some of the differences in the bill between what we have in front of us today and what appears in California and New York. Just a real quick, I'm going to try not to stray from the purview of the committee. Real quick, just want to draw your attention to some of the other comments on the bill on a one-pager in front of you with 14 organizations on it with concerns on this particular approach. I won't go into that. The opportunity to do that was in the last labor committee, but I want to draw your attention to that. But I do want to just say this bill does impact retailers, consumers, workers, the supply chain, the logistics chain, and nobody cares about workers more than those that are employing them, and we know that the health and safety of those workers are really, really important. And we hope that Dolly and Minosha continue to do their job relative to the responsibilities they have in responding to worker concerns and warehouses today. Just real quick, two things really for the committee under your jurisdiction. I want to point out that the scope of this legislation does exceed kind of the laws that were passed in California and New York. There are some new definitions here that I would consider vague and in some cases somewhat broad. That we don't see in those other bills, and they relate to what is an employee and what is work speed data. This bill would not only apply to warehouse workers, but would also apply to courier and express service drivers as well, just to flag a couple of things. And then there's some differences in timelines and notification requirements. Ultimately, those differences and ambiguities create compliance problems for warehouse operators and could lead to adverse actions and penalties under the bill. Most germane to this committee, and Representative Greenman mentioned it, we probably have a difference of opinion on the private right of action. Unlike California and New York, which do not have that private cause of action, we'd prefer that this bill rely on the agency enforcement. We feel the best enforcement paradigm for this bill surrounds that consistent enforcement by the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. That department, along with Minosha, already have working relationships with warehouses and the responsibility for protecting workers and worker safety. Clarity for employers and employees, we feel, is really best accomplished through that enforcement mechanism and not by private attorneys. Moreover, the agency provides a more productive venue for addressing technical violations or differences in interpretation of the law while still empowering the state to address issues. So with that, I'll just end with a quick note that worker safety, again, is top of mind for Minnesota employers. Nobody benefits from an injured worker in any way, shape, manner, or form, and we hope to continue to discuss this bill with Representative Greenman as it moves forward in the process and highlight the differences between California and New York and the Minnesota approach. So thank you, Representative Greenman. Madam Chair, thank you for the time today.
All right, thank you. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, we'll move on to member discussion. Thank you. Discussion to the bill, and as mentioned, the reason this bill is in our committee is because of Subdivision 6, so the question really before us is whether we want there to be this enforcement mechanism. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill's author, I feel like there were some compelling points made there by the Minnesota Retail Association. And is this something that you're willing to work on with them, or are you kind of set in stone on the current language?
Representative Greenman, noting that we did make two amendments.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, we have actually been working on, and the amendments we just adopted actually reflect particularly going from 100 to 250, really looking at the big employers and also containing the language to warehouse work. I will say I think we probably all agree in Minnesota we want a Minnesota model. We've been looking at New York and California, but we've been really talking to and thinking about the unique situation here in Minnesota. So I think that that's where we're at. When I think about the private right of action, what we want to do is ensure that these workers have the ability to protect themselves and make sure that they have the data. We're talking about companies that are collecting immense amount of surveillance data, and one of the things this bill does is require notice and then also require that data be provided. And we think it's important that those workers have the ability to go get that data. There's a compliance mechanism through OSHA or through Department of Labor and Industry, but we think a private right of action is also a really important tool.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Greenman, for that answer. And I do appreciate the amendment today. I think it gives a lot of employers some more specificity on who this bill would apply to. My question is do you have data on, obviously you said that the data shows that more people have been injured. I feel like I'm not sure why this bill is needed if Min, OSHA, and Dolly are doing their jobs and finding, you know, and reacting to this workplace issue. Why is this bill specifically needed?
Representative Greenman, I believe we do have someone from MnOSHA.
Yeah, well, and I actually can answer this because we had a long discussion about this in labor. And one of the questions is, and I agree, and I think we need to support and actually support the role that the important role that OSHA plays. We're going to have lots of bills up about making sure that they have more investigators to do their jobs. But this is actually a new This is created by a new problem. It's created by a level of tracking and surveillance that we haven't seen before. And one of the reasons that this is responsive to something new that's happening. Like in 2007, when we had a challenge in our hospitals, we passed the Safe Patient Handling Act. This is similar. It is responding to a problem that we're seeing, that we're hearing, that we're seeing in the data. And we need a particular mechanism to respond to that. And so I don't know if we do have the director of OSHA here, but I think if the question is why do we need a new law, the answer is we are legislators and we should look at problems and then say what are the tools that our agencies and our workers need. They need a new tool, and we think that this is the right tool.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam.
Any further discussion to the bill? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. And Representative Greenman, I'm just curious about this biometric data that you're talking about that is being collected. Is that data made available to OSHA? if they were to ask for it and want to look into the conditions in the warehouse?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that, I don't know if that's a longer conversation or not. What I will say is this, what this bill does, one, is give access to the employee themselves, and then there's a provision that says if a warehouse is over 30%, has an injury rate that's over 30% of the average of these NAICS codes, of sort of the industry average, that Dolly can open up an investigation and look at those places where there's really high injury rates, which I assume would include that data, that work speed and other data.
I will note, we talk about data a lot, but this isn't public data that we're talking about in this bill, so this isn't Chapter 13 type data. any follow-up, Representative Figge?
Just thank you for that answer, and I appreciate that distinction, and I think that the availability of that data to folks outside of the private retailers will be necessary for us to understand how this civil action would be done, and just generally this bill seems so mild to me. I look forward to the next few steps. We can make sure that people are actually being expected to do reasonable work.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Greenman, the work speed data that this requires to be disclosed to workers, that data, if it's currently collected, am I right in understanding that under the current law, if a worker has a basis to bring a wage and hour claim or a basis to bring an OSHA claim, or if Dolly or the Minnesota OSHA have a basis to start an enforcement action or an investigation, that's data that those companies would have to produce under current law once that threshold is met. Is that accurate?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate, I know that this is the data committee, so I got to be more precise. We're not talking about sort of public data, so I appreciate that. That might be a question that I will phone a friend, our Director Kruger of OSHA, if we have the current legal ability to do that. So, if Madam Chair, if that's okay.
Hopefully you're paying attention. introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Sure. I am James Kruger. I'm with the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm the Minnesota OSHA Enforcement Director. In regards to OSHA and how we do inspections really is what we're talking about here. When we're looking at these types of injuries or speeds or those types of things, we would use what's called the General Duty Clause, which says it has to be free from recognized hazards. So with that, we have to have a history of injuries and types of things. Really, it occurs after somebody's hurt to really issue the citations. So this type of bill is something that gets that data out there before people get hurt.
Representative Niska, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the explanation. Just so I'm tracking properly, once you have some sort of basis to start an investigation, now you have broad discovery tools to go out and find that data and make sure that employers give you the information you need for your investigation as the law currently stands. And that would include things like this work speed data. Is that accurate?
Director Kruger.
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, OSHA, as it does investigations, we have the tools that we can get what we need. Obviously, the courts are involved at that time. It can be a long, in-depth process, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Niska.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is, I guess, the real concern I have with this bill is that it doesn't make any more data available or require the companies to keep it. It just places a target on a particular type of company and says that you're sort of subject to a open fishing expedition pre-lawsuit or pre-any procedural barrier or safeguard to before initiate that there's no need for a reason for an investigation just because of the type of business that you're in, that you're sort of an open season for either the agency or plaintiff's lawyers to do pre-suit or pre-investigation discovery. And so that's why that really concerns me about the overall approach of the bill, and in particular the enforcement mechanism of it. It's telling a particular type of business that You're really not welcome in the state of Minnesota, and we're going to put a bigger litigation and investigation target on you. And, you know, it's a type of business that I think benefits people of Minnesota quite a bit. We all have gotten used to the idea that if you need something and you don't have time to go to Target, you can go on Amazon and, you know, order something. At least in the metro area, you can get it delivered to your house that same day. I'm concerned that this is going to cause companies to not want to do business in Minnesota and maybe put their warehouses like this in Hudson, Wisconsin, where it's not going to serve Minnesota as well, and it's going to move jobs out of the state of Minnesota. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Greenman.
Yeah, so I want to remind folks of what this bill does, which is it says if you're going to have a quota that you're going to hold a worker accountable for, that they could be disciplined for, you have to tell them what it is. You have to tell somebody if you're required to lift a certain, or if you're required to stow a certain amount of boxes, or you're required to do a certain amount of things in a certain amount of time, you have to give the employee notice of what it is. And if you're going to track that, you have to give people access to that. The reason that we have a problem is because right now people are being held to a standard that they're not told about. And so people are working really frenetically. They're constantly, there's a fear of not meeting a quota that they don't oftentimes have access to. And so they're not going to the bathroom. They're not taking breaks. They're not asking for help. In labor, we heard from workers who work at many warehouses, big ones, UPS, Cisco, who are actually doing it the right way. And people work there. We had two workers who were there for 30 plus years, right? And they talked about their performance standards. They talked about quotas and how they were measured, and they were built with the bodies and the ergonomics of people in mind. What we have right now, and we're seeing this, is not just a Minnesota problem, but the Shakopee warehouses in Minnesota are the most dangerous place to work in Minnesota, and it's 100% preventable injuries. We're talking about MESCO, skeletal injuries from lifting, from moving. And so when we think about how can workers keep themselves safe, one, they could know, we can make sure people know, if you're required to lift this many boxes or you're required to stow this many boxes, you actually know the number and are not operating in this dark speed up world. We're not talking about a boon for plaintiff's attorneys. This is actually quite limited civil right action, and as you know, as many folks know who are lawyers, we're not talking about much money. The reality is this is a prophylactic measure that's meant to keep people from getting hurt. And one of the ways we know how to do that, and we know this from other industries, is we make sure that those quotas that people have and are required to meet, that folks know what they are and that they have access to their data. That's what this bill does. And to Representative Finke's point, it is actually a relatively modest response to a really big problem that is hurting Minnesota workers.
Thank you. Representative Carroll, and I'll remind members, we got two other bills on the agenda, and the question before us, we're really talking about the enforcement mechanism.
Thank you, Representative Carroll. I'll be very quick. I just wanted to comment that perhaps with the advent of same-day delivery, it points out the very need for this kind of bill, and so I appreciate the author's efforts to accomplish that. Thank you.
Yeah, I know. I tell my kids when something seems too good to be true and is too convenient and too cheap, it's at the expense of something. So I do appreciate you bringing this forward, Representative Greenman. Any closing comments, although those were pretty good closing comments just a minute ago?
yes, and I would just say thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill. Thank you for the discussion. We are talking about the most profitable company in America and probably the world. So these are mechanisms that are actually making money off the backs of hurting workers. This is not, we're not talking about an industry that can't afford to do this and provide the service they're providing. We are talking about a company that absolutely can afford to keep people safe and also do this work. And in fact, many companies in Minnesota are doing this. UPS, Cisco, again, we heard those testimonies. So I just say, as we consider this, our job in the legislature is to respond to problems that are hurting, that are affecting Minnesota workers. This absolutely is, and I think that this bill does that. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd ask for your support.
All right. Seeing no further discussion to the bill, I will renew my motion that House File 36, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next up, we've got another worker bill, Representative Hansen R. Representative Hansen, I will move your bill. I will move that House File 70 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. I understand that you also have an A2 author's amendment to get it in the shape that you would like. So I'll go ahead and move the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 70, as amended, is the latest in an effort relating to the Packing House Workers Bill of Rights, which I first carried in 2007, which was just yesterday, I think. But we have been working on this for a very long time, and we were able to compromise back in 2007 and get some law in. We had a legislative auditor review in 2015 that provided recommendations that are somewhat incorporated into this bill. And the Department of Labor and Industry conducted a working group in, I think, the last 3 years, providing input to update the law. The provisions that are here in front of you and the amendment that was just adopted, what you adopted was the fiscal note consequence, so we put the money in that came from the fiscal note, and then also updating some of the penalty provisions. Some of these provisions have not been updated for decades, but the world has moved on, and so the responsibilities and the issues relating to the Packing House Workers Bill of Rights. Meat packing, you know, 100 years ago was a very dangerous business. It is still a very dangerous business. And there's been great consolidation in the industry since 2007. So I'm asking for your support for the bill as amended. I have a couple of testifiers. I do have Bernie Hess from UFCW and also the Department of Labor and Industry that can describe the provisions that were amended and why the enforcement is in front of it.
All right. We didn't have anyone sign up ahead of time, but welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Bernie Hess. I'm with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. We're a union that represents packing house workers, retail, medical cannabis workers, nursing home workers, and some light manufacturing. We'd like to thank you for hearing the bill. I'd like to thank Representative Hansen, who's just been a warrior for us over the years with worker safety. It's time. He talked about how dangerous packing houses are. They're much more dangerous now than when I was a young man because of automation. You can get cut, burnt, fried, shocked, poisoned. There's slips, trips, and falls, and we need some teeth. Knowledge is power, and the more workers know, the safer the worker will be. It's good for the company, safer food system also. There are many things that go on in packing houses. What really heightened this is COVID a few years ago. Because the workers didn't have the presumptive thing for workers' comp, very few workers were able to take or use workers' comp. It was high, like up 97% of the claims made were denied. So think about that. Another good thing in the bill is the fact that workers will know exactly what to expect when it comes to pay. A lot of packing houses use temp agencies. Often they're not told that when they get paid, that every time they use their card to pull some money out, there's like a $1.50 charge for the ATM. We support the bill, stand for any questions, and this is very, we want work where you can go to work and come home in one piece. That's all we ask.
All Thank you for your testimony. Any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Not seeing anyone, we'll move on to member discussion. Members, discussion to the bill, remembering again we're sort of the reasons here in this committee is the civil action provisions. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Scott.
I guess I'll ask the question. Nobody else on the team is raising their hand at this point. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, the penalties and fines here, where are those, if someone's fined $400, where does that money go now?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do have a Department of Labor and Industry here who could provide the direct answers on that.
All right. Please introduce yourself, and then I go ahead with your response.
My name is Jessica Gross. I'm the Director of Labor Standards and Apprenticeship at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. This bill addresses three current laws in Minnesota. So currently two of the three laws do not have fines attached to them. The third law that does have fines attached to it currently, if fines were collected, they would go to the state.
All right, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, so under this bill, then where would those fines go?
Director Gross.
So under House File 70, one of the changes would be that the Department of Labor and Industry would have the right to seek penalties under the migrant labor law. And in that amendment, the Department of Labor and Industry would provide penalties assessed to the worker aggrieved. The most recent amendments, the fines that are assessed would also go to the worker aggrieved as opposed to the state.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, why the change?
Representative Hansen.
The worker aggrieved is kind of a technical term. That could be the person who got their hand cut off or person who is somehow hurt. Or it could be as simple as the notification. And I think the penalties are going to be applicable. If they weren't notified of some of their rights, they could be aggrieved. And usually what the agencies do is a step level of enforcement based on, you know, is it a technical violation? Is it something that has happened before? So I would like penalties to go to the worker aggrieved.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I certainly understand that if you lose a finger or a hand or whatever, that, you know, that should be accounted for, right? That the people should be made whole. But wouldn't that happen under work comp, or wouldn't that happen, you know, you've got this private right of action here. Wouldn't those things happen anyway without this? Like, what happens now, I guess, is the question. If someone, you know, loses a digit or a wrist, that sort of thing, aren't they already made whole in some way?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scott. To go back to the penalty question, so two out of the three penalties, there is no financial consequence. For the one, it is a financial consequence. It goes into the state general fund. So I believe it's better for that financial consequence, the penalty, to go towards the worker aggrieved. In terms of the workers' comp, those questions, I would defer to the Department of Labor and Industry.
Director Gross.
So basically this bill addresses the migrant labor law. It addresses the recruitment and food processing law, and it addresses the Packing House Worker Bill of Rights. Currently, under the Packing House Worker Bill of Rights, there is no private right of action, and DLI cannot assess fines. So the bill basically would allow DLI to assess fines, and there would also be a private right of action. The fines assessed would not be related to, for example, losing a finger. It would be under the jurisdiction of labor standards, and so, for example, we assess fines or penalties. In this case, if a required statement is not provided to packing house workers that are protected under the bill. In terms of the recruitment and food processing employment law, currently there is a mechanism for DLI to assess fines. There is a private right of action, but again, it's not related to an injury. It's related to providing written information at the time of recruitment. And the third law, the migrant labor law, right now there is a private right of action, and DLI does not have authority under the migrant labor law. So this would provide us with authority to also assess penalties. This law also is not related to injuries. It's related to information provided at the time of recruitment, as well as other guarantees such as a biweekly 70-hour pay guarantee.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, in the environmental world where I work a lot of my stuff, in the environment world, we often say prevention is better than cleanup. And if we look at the laws that we're changing here, most of them are notification, just simple notification about rights, responsibilities, having the language available so that the employee knows. So we believe that information is power that can help prevent injuries. It can help prevent problems in terms of not knowing wages, but also what's there. Providing this information, we think, helps the employer and the employee in terms of making sure that everybody knows what's there. And overall, that should help reduce injuries and provide a better work experience.
Further follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And final, just more of a statement. So I guess I was confusing because of your comments about the cutting off of a hand or whatever. That's really not what this bill's talking about. You're saying that this bill is sort of preemptive. This isn't about making a person whole as you would through work comp or some other lawsuit based on a permanent injury like that. So I was just confused that was brought into this conversation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I think I would note too, I don't think if somebody loses a finger or a hand, it's possible to make them whole. And so I think the idea that we'd prevent that would be a good thing. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a question for the author. So the fines and penalties provision, do you intend it to prevent the worker from seeking civil action, damages, so that it's not the cap on their damages? They can seek civil damages with a lawsuit, correct?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Carroll, that is correct. It is not a cap. It's not an either or. It's that they have that. They would have that in the statute as an aggrieved person, and they still have their liability on it.
And Chair.
Representative Carroll.
So they wouldn't be stopped from seeking civil damages under this provision.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Carroll, correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Hansen, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but I do have some concerns and some questions. First of all, for the notification that's required in here, which you want to get, does this just have to be a posting, or do they have to individually explain all the policies to each individual?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so are you relating to Section 3?
Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson.
Well, Chair Beckerfin, Representative Hansen, we're talking about the fines that shall be imposed. It's not an option by golly. But some of these fines are going to be, that will be imposed, is because lack of notification on safety issues or the $1.50 charge on the ATM. So I'm wondering if all that information that the individuals or the company can be fined and the fines go to the employee, what is the proper notification required so that these fines don't occur?
Representative Johnson, the answer is actually on lines 2.7 to 2.10. At the start of employment, they provided in writing in the worker's native language. So any follow-up, Representative Johnson?
Chair Beckerfin, I was just trying to make sure that was on the record. That's why I did that line of question. And it's a change that the fines no longer go to the state, which would be the general fund, and in the apparently there's not too many fines being issued because there is no impact in the fiscal note about fines. So, but since the commissioner shall issue the fines and it's going to go to the employee, I thought I wanted to make sure that was on the record.
Thank you. And you know, I will note too, for so folks understand, you know, a civil right of action isn't like you file a form and you get a check in the mail. It's a whole court process that folks would have to go through. Representative Niska?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hansen. I'm hoping to get a little bit more clarity in what it means for an employee to be injured by a violation of that's the first few words in the civil action provisions, both in Section 4 and Section 9 of this bill. And in particular, you know, we're talking about, I appreciate the clarification that we're talking about disclosure, not about necessarily someone losing a limb or having a physical injury. And I'm just trying to understand if an employee is injured by this, by these provisions, just by not receiving the disclosure, or if there has to be some additional problem that happens to them as a result of not receiving the disclosure.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would have Department of Labor and Industry come forward. If you look at the different sections that are, it says injured by a violation of this section, that's section 179.86. And if Department of Labor and Industry could reference that component.
Yep, one of those times where you wish you had 179.86 actually in front of you and not just the numbered sections. Director Gross.
I would note, Madam Chair.
Representative Niska.
If I can help out.
Yep, you can't just butt in when you want to. You got to wait for me to call on you. So, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. We do have some of the pertinent language of 179.86, at least as proposed to be amended in the section before. That's all I need.
Yes, no, I'm fully aware of that, but one of the things that is, for those of us who've been here for a while, is you have to know everything that's in the whole chapter, because everything in that whole chapter would apply, and we don't, they don't print it out that way, or we'd go through way more paper than we already do. Director Gross.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to provide some background information as well. The language that is added, starting at line 3.3, the civil action, under the Packing House Worker Bill of Rights, is actually taken from current language in law under the Recruitment and Food Processing Law. So under 181.635, that is the current language in terms of a civil action that is available for enforcement of the Recruitment and Food Processing Law as well. But typically, in terms of an employee being injured by a violation, here that would mean that they were not provided with the required information in written form at the time of at the start of employment. The injury could refer to the timing of receiving the written required information. It could have to do with the manner in which the information was provided, or it could have to do with not all of the information that is required to be provided being provided to the worker, because basically this written information that must be provided refers to the terms and conditions as well as the rights of packing house workers.
Representative Niska, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that answer. It's just to help me understand how this is going to work then. So in Section 3, it adds a requirement that the name of the employer's workers' compensation insurance carrier, the carrier's phone number, and the insurance policy number be provided in writing. If, for example, the disclosure includes the name of the carrier and the carrier's phone number but not the policy number, that's a violation of that employee has been under this injured by it, and there's an automatic at least $1,000 penalty or double damages. And if they intentionally left out the policy number, then that would be treble damages. Am I understanding the way those provisions work together correctly?
Director Gross.
So the provision that DLI would be enforcing is under subdivision 6, the fines. So in terms of the fines, DLI has the discretion to issue a fine of not less than or more than 1,000 for each violation. So DLI would have some discretion in terms of what the fine was that they issued. And I will also say that that DLI also exercises discretion, or labor standards exercises discretion, in which cases we take for investigation. So not everything results in an investigation. We certainly want to focus on education and preventative measures to help to get employers into compliance, as opposed to always investigating. And so this provision in terms of fines and the fines that we would issue have to do when we would embark on an investigation.
Representative Niska, final follow-up.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really do appreciate very much your robust explanation of the DLI enforcement process. I think that's a better way to handle this provision than Section 4, the Subdivision 5 civil action, which does provide for much higher penalties and costs and attorney's fees, and does not really allow the employer to have the comfort of DLI's discretion in whether or not to go after it. If I'm understanding this correctly, I think this is really creating a pretty big litigation trap for unintentional disclosure failures by employers, and again a private right of action that I think is disproportionate and not as well sort of articulated as the DLI enforcement process here. So that's really my concern with the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Representative Hansen, response and final words on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And kind of in response and final words, I would say information is power. Representative Scott, I apologize for any intention of or any impact of not being clear. I believe that information is power, and that by providing this information, which we have tried to do since 2007, can provide help for the employer and the employee. And essentially at that start of work, letting folks know what their rights are and that starts a good relationship between the employer and the employee. And that information can help them throughout their career in the packing house, which is still a very dangerous place to be. And that information can help them when they're working in these very tough conditions. So I'd appreciate your yes vote today. Also, if you'd like to co-author the bill, you all know how to do that, and I'd ask for your support on that. And look forward to continuing this journey that we began 16 years ago to try to improve the working conditions and the information for the workers in the packing houses.
All right. Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House File 70, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Stevenson, welcome to the committee. I'm not going to read the title of your bill. It's really long. House File 17. So I will move House File 17 be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. And I understand that you do have an author's amendment, the A6 amendment, so we'll go ahead and move that. All those in favor of the, well, any discussion of the A6? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The amendment is adopted. Representative Stephen, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 17 is a bill to get at the soaring high costs of pharmaceuticals. You know, we all just came off a period of many months of talking to our constituents at their doors in the campaign season, and I'm sure I'm not the only one in this room who feels that the most among the most memorable conversations that I had were with people who were struggling with the high cost of their medications, people making really difficult and terrible choices about what not to go without, you know, what not to buy in order to afford the drugs or whether to ration medications. It's a situation that absolutely demands prompt and serious action. This bill contains two ways of getting at the problem. And I usually say that the high cost of pharmaceuticals is not a problem that has one solution. There is no silver bullet. We need silver buckshot. We have a couple of components of that in the bill before you today. And returning members, both components should be familiar to you. The first is a bill, the first is the section to go after price gouging in the generic market. This is a bill that's been around for many, many years, and we've talked about on many occasions. And the second provision is a little bit newer proposal to create a prescription drug affordability board. I always say that this is a little bit like the PUC for drugs. The Public Utilities Commission helps consumers deal with the monopolistic power of our energy utilities and ensuring that they're not taken advantage of by their utilities. PDAB would similarly deal with the monopolistic power that someone who has a life-saving drug has over the people who need the drug to live. The bill's before the committee largely because of several provisions that include civil penalties. Those are found in sections 4, 5, 14, and 18. There's a data provision in section 13 as well as in the A6 amendment, which you were just kind enough to adopt. And then there's an appeals provision in section 14. Madam Chair, I know there's a number of testifiers wishing to speak to the bill.
All right. First on the list, I have Jason Plegancool. Please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. Jason Plegancool. I'm an Assistant Attorney General and Manager of the Consumer Wage and Antitrust Division of the Attorney General's Office. Attorney General Ellison regrets that he can't be here with you today, but he asked me to testify in his stead in order to voice his strong support for House File 17, which takes important steps to combat the high cost Minnesotans pay for prescription drugs. In 2019, the Attorney General convened a task force to study the problem of the high cost of prescription drugs and to make recommendations to tackle this problem. The task force makeup was bipartisan and included experts on prescription drug pricing, patients, medical practitioners, as well as representatives from the Board of Pharmacy and the legislature. The task force ultimately published a 93-page report that not only diagnosed the contributing causes to the high drug prices Minnesotans experience, but also made 14 recommendations to lower the cost of prescription drugs in Minnesota. Two of the task force 14 recommendations are embodied in House File 14. First, prohibiting drug manufacturers from imposing excessive price increases on drugs sold in Minnesota. And second, establishing a drug affordability board that can investigate cost increases on prescription drugs, publish reports on pricing trends, and when appropriate, set a ceiling or cap on the amount paid to purchase drugs that create an affordability challenge to Minnesotans. If House File 17 is enacted, Minnesota would be, I believe, the eighth state in the country that has established such a board. House File 17 would help rein in the high costs being paid for life-saving medications. And unfortunately, excessive price increases of both generic and branded prescription drugs continue to cause affordability challenges to Minnesotans. To name just one example that the enactment of this bill could help address, Acthar is a branded medication that's used to treat multiple conditions, including lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. Originally, it was approved by the FDA in 2010 and was sold by Sanofi at a list price of $40 per vial. After it was purchased by another manufacturer, today it's now sold at nearly $40,000 per vial. This is not an isolated incident. According to one federal HHS report, in 2022 alone, multiple drugs increased their list prices by more than $20,000 or by more than 500%. Enacting House File 17 would go a long way to help Minnesota combat this problem. The Attorney General's office has an important role to play under this bill. The Attorney General has the authority to investigate and bring enforcement actions against prohibited excessive price increases of generic drugs. The Attorney General's office would provide legal services to the board that this bill would create. And the Attorney General also would have the authority to take enforcement actions to ensure any upper payment limits set by that board are not being violated. In sum, House File 17 goes a long way towards enacting the recommendations of Attorney General Ellison's award-winning Drug Pricing Task Force report and would help Minnesotans afford their lives and live with dignity and respect by helping to lower the enormous costs that they bear when purchasing life-saving drugs. For these reasons, Attorney General Ellison strongly supports House File 17 and urges the committee to support its passage. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We do have a couple other people signed up to testify. I have Bob Miller. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
I'm Bob Miller. I live in Prior Lake, Minnesota. And I have multiple sclerosis. I'm here because I'm among the nearly 40% of the people living in, with multiple sclerosis who have altered the use of their medications due to cost. When I was diagnosed almost 20 years ago, it started with a tingle in my cheek, then dizziness and slurred speech. Then I started having difficulty with one of my legs. At one point, it got so bad that I was slurring my speech every 15 minutes and getting dizzy as well. Within a few months, I was prescribed Betaseron, a disease-modifying therapy, or DMT, that has been shown to modify the course of MS and prevent the accumulation of disability. Symptoms and prescriptions therapies vary widely for unpredictable MS, and Betaseron happened to work for me for 12 years. I took an injection every other day for 12 years. When introduced in 1993, Betaseron cost $11,500. By 2022, the cost had risen to over $111,000. Median cost for MS DMTs was $94,000 in 2022, and when generics are included in that figure, it's still $80,000. Insurance companies often treat generics for specialty drugs just like a specialty drug, so the costs are still prohibitively high. I'm on a fixed income, and that amount jeopardizes my family's retirement security. When I stopped taking Betaseron, my doctors told me I was rolling the dice. Luckily, I haven't had a relapse in those 7 years. But I don't know what my future holds. I strongly feel that no one should have to make that kind of a decision, and medications can improve people's lives if people can't afford to access them. The National MS Society applauds the HF17's intent to bring more transparency, discussion, and attention to the high cost of prescription drugs for people with chronic conditions. We appreciate the Prescription Drug Affordability Act bill utilizes a multi-stakeholder approach in acknowledging the roles of health plans, employers, clinical researchers, drug manufacturers, patients, and others. People with chronic illness like MS need to know that they'll be able to get the life-changing medication that they need when they need it. I urge your support for the Prescription Drug Affordability Act, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I have Kip Snyder.
Good
Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kip Snyder. I'm National Vice President of State Policy for Pharma, which is the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. We're the National Trade Association for the research-based pharmaceutical industry. We're here today to oppose House File 17. We understand and we agree completely with the goal of making medicines more available for patients. However, we believe that there are multiple better solutions than trying to have the state set prices for pharmaceuticals, which is in essence what this bill does. So I'll be happy to review those better options in detail if time allows. We oppose House File 17 for a variety of reasons. Some of those are based on policy, some of those are based on operational feasibility and patient impact, and some of those are more legally oriented. And so for this committee, let me touch briefly on the legal concerns. Those are also outlined in the submission in writing that we put in with the committee. So it's clear that state attempts to set drug prices raise serious legal issues. First, specifically with respect to medicines that are patented, price setting raises concerns under the Supremacy Clause, the United States Constitution, because it restricts the goals of our nation's patent laws. There's a key case on this point where the District of Columbia attempted to set prices for patented medicines. The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit struck down that law, reasoning that it conflicted with the objectives of the federal patent system as established by Congress. On top of that, this bill raises concerns under the so-called Dormant Commerce Clause, which precludes states from regulating commercial activity beyond their borders. There's also a federal court of appeals case in this space where a Maryland statute was struck down. So what we really have with this legislation is a bill that establishes a state framework to set prices for drugs, and it references the maximum fair price that was just enacted by Congress as part of the Inflation Reduction Act. But there's really no detail in this legislation about how all this would actually work, no adequate explanation or clear standards, and this raises due process concerns in addition. You know, the bill would simply have the state board declare that here's what the price is going to be in Minnesota. And from a timing perspective, as I understand it, this bill would begin to be effective August 1st of this year. So I'd ask the committee to keep in mind that under the Inflation Reduction Act, maximum fair prices become public in 2024. However, they aren't effectively implemented in the Medicare program until 2026. So Minnesota, under this bill, would be essentially setting the federal government's published prices before they're even implemented at the federal level. So we have concerns that that could impact or derail what the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is actually working on right now. I want to be absolutely clear, pharma strongly opposes price setting both at the federal and the state levels. We believe it hampers innovation. We believe there are all sorts of unintended consequences that it would harm patients. And as referenced, we have what we think are better, lawful, proven, practical solutions that can help patients address their affordability challenges right now. So I'll wrap up there. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Judy Cook.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Judy Cook, here today on behalf of the Association for Accessible Medicines, representing the generic and biosimilar manufacturers. AAM is opposed to House File 17. The first sections of the bill only apply to low-cost generic drugs, not brand drugs that actually drive up costs for patients. This is misplaced, and there are significant constitutional issues with the bill. Generic and biosimilar medicines save patients 91% of prescriptions filled, but only 18% of the drug spend, and make up only 2% of total health care spending. This does not address the cost drivers in the prescription drug marketplace, provides false hope to consumers and does nothing with respect to the examples cited by the Attorney General earlier. It allows the Attorney General to sue a generic company when the wholesale cost, not the patient cost, increases by $30. But no suit will be filed for a brand drug that is increased by thousands of dollars a month. There will be constitutional challenges. The fiscal note from 2021 shows that the state of Maryland had to pay AAM attorney's fees when their law was found unconstitutional. But the fundamental question is why this only targets generic drugs, the competitive marketplace. Generic drugs are sold to wholesalers. Then the wholesalers own the product and determine which generic manufacturer's products are sold in Minnesota. In most instances, the transaction between the manufacturer and the wholesaler is not in Minnesota, which is the constitutional issue here, because all generic drugs are subject to price control, whether or not the parties to the sale were in the state. After that sale, the manufacturer is no longer in control of the price. But this bill only applies to the manufacturer's price. So regardless of where a price increase occurs, only a manufacturer can be sued because there is an exemption for the downstream parties in subsequent sales. It also requires all generic manufacturers to maintain a registered agent and office in Minnesota and attempt to get around the concerns in the Maryland case. The constitutional problem is not the connection to the state. Maryland lost because the regulation goes to any out-of-state upstream transaction, the same as House File 17. Regarding the prohibition of withdrawal of generic drugs from the state, again, it's the wholesaler who sells drugs to pharmacies, and the manufacturer has no control over where their drug is sold or not sold or the final price to consumer. It is also likely that requiring the continued sale of the product is also unconstitutional. There is a private right of action, which means that a manufacturer could be subject to multiple suit, and the bill prejudges that every suit is in the public benefit. Also, the multiple penalties for the same offense appear to be stacked and indeterminate by the manufacturer because of their sale of the drug was made to the wholesaler and not individuals in Minnesota. Finally, and I am wrapping up, the FDA has recently placed multiple generic drugs on their drug shortage list due to supply chain shocks, but this bill does not permit consideration of material increases to the manufacturers, such as increased cost of ingredients or packaging that impact pricing. We also have concerns with the Drug Affordability Board provisions, but encourage you not to adopt the generic drug price gouging section of House File 17. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any. We do have an amendment from the committee, I believe, Representative Niska. This is your amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and tell us about it?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A5 amendment. The A5 amendment is targeted directly at the private right of action provision in the statute. And, you know, I question whether there is a there's any private right of action needed. It does, the bill does provide for the Attorney General to take all of the, use all the powers under 8.31, which would include the ability to provide restitution to any individuals who are harmed. And I think it would be preferable to make sure that the enforcement of this provision is limited in that way. But I think if we are gonna have a private right of action provision, we shouldn't be prejudging legal issues that are going to come up in that lawsuit, and in particular what the bill does, and the amendment is trying to take this language out of it, would be to take away from the district court judges in Minnesota the public benefit question that is currently raised in any private attorney general case. So in order for a private plaintiff to access the powers of the private attorney general statute under current Minnesota law from a Minnesota Supreme Court case called Lee v. Nystrom in 2000. The plaintiff has to show that they're not just bringing this claim for their own private benefit, but they're actually bringing a claim for the broader public benefit in order to step into the shoes of the attorney general. And the lines on page 4, lines 19 and 20 of the bill, prejudges that issue in every single case brought for an injury under this excessive price increase provision. I think it's It's unwise for us to prejudge that issue in every one of those cases. It may very well be that most plaintiffs would be able to meet that that burden and make that showing, but I think that that should be a case-by-case determination made by district court judges in those particular cases and not a decision made by us as the legislature in advance of any of those lawsuits being brought. So that's why I am offering the A5 amendment, Madam Chair, and I ask for your support.
All right. Any response to the A5 amendment, Representative Stevenson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Niska. I oppose the A5 amendment, would ask members to vote it down. As Representative Niska indicated, this doesn't remove the private right of action from the bill. What it does is remove the requirement that the plaintiff establish that the action's in the public's interest, which is not in statute that they have to establish that. It is the result of a 2000 court decision, the Nystrom decision that Representative Niska mentioned, that I believe was wrongly decided, and frankly, I think this committee should consider legislation to reverse that writ large. So I don't think that we should limit people's ability to seek relief from the courts based on artificial, court-inspired tests that came literally decades after the underlying statute was passed. So I'd ask the committee to vote down the A5.
All right. Any further discussion specifically to the A5 amendment? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
No. So wait. I'm sorry.
All right. Yeah. I think everyone was asleep, so we're gonna redo that one. All those in favor of the A5 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by saying no.
No.
All right. The amendment is not
almost
adopted. All right. Now to the underlying bill, not amended. Let's see. We've got Representative Feist. Discussion to the underlying bill.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out something in the bill that I think addressed one of the testifiers, but mostly I wanted to tell my own personal story. But I'll just point on page 2. It looks like Representative Stevenson can confirm, but it looks like if the price increase is directly related to costs incurred by the manufacturer to provide that drug to the public, then they are exempt from this. Is that correct?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Feist, yes.
Right. Further comments, Representative Feist.
Thank you. Thank you. I thought that was important clarification. But I just wanted to share my own personal story. I have asthma. I've had it since I was born, and it's very severe. And I've been on drugs to make me breathe my whole life. Without them, I would stop breathing. And there was a period of time where Advair, which is a drug that changed my life, was not available to me because my insurance changed and they said that they weren't going to pay for it and they wanted me to be on another drug. And my doctor was like, no, this is the only one that works. And I had to switch drugs and I ended up in the hospital. And it was only then, coincidentally, when my insurance also got better, that my insurance company said they would pay for my Advair again. But I know what it is like to be completely dependent on a drug that I take every day of my life to be able to breathe. And I know what it's like to not be able to afford it. And I just think that this is an incredibly important bill, and I thank you for bringing it.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to follow up on the question from Representative Feist, first of all, and really make sure we're clear on the language of the exemption on the bottom of page 2, because if I heard the testimony correctly, it was about a manufacturer not being able to point to increase in costs of a component in a drug. And as I'm reading the exemption line, bottom of page 2, lines 25 through 28, it only is an exemption for a wholesale distributor or a pharmacy to increase the price if the price increase is directly attributable to additional costs imposed by the manufacturer of the drug. Am I reading that correctly, Representative Stevenson? That the exemption does not help a manufacturer who has a problem with the price increase in a component of the drug.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Niska, I think subdivision 3 is, is pretty clear. It says it's not a violation if the price increase is directly attributable to additional costs for a wholesaler, distributor, or pharmacy. If the price that is directly attributable, excuse me, my voice is failing this morning, additional costs of the drug imposed on the wholesale, distributor, or pharmacy by the manufacturer of the drug.
Follow-up, Representative Niska. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think the testimony was raising a question that is not really addressed by this exemption and a concern. And the testimony from Ms. Cook on behalf of the generic manufacturers also, she asserted that most of the sales between manufacturers and wholesalers happen outside of the state of Minnesota. Is that a factually accurate statement?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Niska, sitting here today, I don't have any data for you on that matter. I think that, we very clearly in this bill have provisions to ensure that we are on sound constitutional footing with regard to the Commerce Clause and including the registered agent provision. So I am not concerned about that particular issue.
Any further discussion to the bill? Representative Niska, additional follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stevenson. Just to clarify, though, the at least some transactions that this is regulating the price of happen between a manufacturer outside of the state of Minnesota and a wholesaler outside of the state of Minnesota. Is that accurate?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Niska, again, I think that the Commerce Clause issues related in this bill are adequately addressed by the nature of the bill. I think that the Maryland case that was being discussed was cited on wholly different grounds. I think we've learned from that case and come back to it and adjusted the bill to make it better.
Representative Niska.
Yeah, one last comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. One last comment. I think you should you and counsel really should study the Maryland case a little bit closer. I think that there is the core holding in that case really is focused directly on the fact that there are upstream there are price regulations happening on upstream transactions, in particular between the retailer and the wholesale distributor, and that it's the regulation or the effort by the state to regulate those that level of the transaction that was the core of the problem, and that the Fourth Circuit struck down the Maryland law. I see the same problem here. I think, I think that we're heading for a lawsuit in which the state of Minnesota is not going to win. It's a lawsuit. It's going to be similar to a lawsuit that the state of Minnesota recently lost in the Eighth Circuit on our gold bullion law, that where the Eighth Circuit said that we were trying to regulate transactions of gold bullion that happened outside of the state of Minnesota, and that overstepped our bounds. So I'm concerned that the author and the Attorney General's office is really not giving enough careful consideration to that liability risk that we're imposing on the state of Minnesota.
Representative Niska, I'm sorry you missed the scintillating discussion on the House floor on the gold bullion bill.
Sure, I was going to say that.
Representative Stevenson.
That Representative Niska should be careful of commenting on that bill if he has any tax bills that he wants to have heard. Would not take shots at the gold bullion.
Representative Stevenson, response to the comments to this bill.
My comments are that, again, we have looked at the Maryland case. I think this bill actually has been modified. Again, it's been around for many years, and it has been modified to directly reflect the Maryland case. I am very confident in the constitutionality of this bill.
All right. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing this bill. I just have heard so many times on the campaign trail about this issue, and I'm so glad that we are trying to at least attempt to tackle some of the problems associated with the cost of prescription drugs. I would like to request a roll call, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Representative Stevenson, I'm concerned that some have said about this bill that it could result in shortages of particular drugs, could also result in fewer drugs being developed, and even result in lower quality of drugs. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on those sorts of statements.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I think they're scaremongering on behalf of the pharmaceutical industry. I'm not convinced at all.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. Well, I'm concerned that if a pharmacy or a provider can't get a medicine because they're not even going to attempt to sell it here in the state of Minnesota, then people in the situation like Representative Feist are not going to be able to get the drug that they need. And so that's my concern with this bill. And I also have another concern, and maybe I'm missing something here, but I've heard it said that 50% of the price of a drug is determined by the manufacturer. The rest is determined by PBMs taking their cut, insurance companies taking their cuts. And so why doesn't this bill address those entities as well?
Representative Stevenson.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Scott, as I mentioned at my opening comments, this is not the silver bullet. This is one of many bills that get at this problem. There are other bills advancing the legislature that go exactly at the issues that you're discussing. For example, Representative Howard has a phenomenal bill related to the cost of out-of-pocket expenses for some of these drugs that's more looking at the insurance aspect of it. And we just got a great research summary from the Department of Commerce showing that that bill, which would hold out-of-pocket costs down for life-saving drugs like insulin, would only add a penny to an annual premium for insurance policy. Only a penny. So we're looking at lots of different avenues. This is just one. But to go back to your first concern, the thing that I would point out to you is that there are many of these drugs that are offered at exorbitantly high prices in the United States are available at much, much, much cheaper prices in other markets around the globe. The fact that pharma is able to offer those drugs in other markets at heavily discounted prices relative to what your constituents and my constituents are forced to pay here in the United States, I think directly contradicts the idea that if we demand a better deal for our constituents, pharma is going to walk away. They're not walking away from Canada. They're not walking away from markets around the globe, and they won't walk away here.
Representative Scott, any follow-up?
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to point out, too, that Representative Feist's issue, I guess, really was with her insurance company. And that's a whole other matter, I guess. One final question, and that is, there's no fiscal note that you're bringing to this committee. And so perhaps this is a question for Madam Chair, is if the fiscal note, when it does come, and I guess I would ask the author too, when does he expect that? But if the fiscal note comes and there's a fiscal cost that would relate to the purview of this committee, will the bill be coming back to this committee for review?
Representative Scott, I don't foresee that happening. Representative Stevenson, it's your bill. I assume you know more about where we're at with the fiscal note.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, in prior years, the cost for this bill has been held entirely in the prescription, the price gouging provision was held entirely in the health omnibus, and PDAB was held entirely in the commerce omnibus. It's my intention for this to come entirely out of the commerce budget this year as chair of the Commerce Committee. That's my intention going forward. We do have a fiscal note request in, but I do not believe there will be any cost out of this committee's budget.
And Representative Scott, I'll note, you know, we amend things and things change all the time, and we don't always call everything back to the committee. I don't, based on previous years and what I know about the language in this bill, I don't foresee that any of this would fall within our budget as the Judiciary Finance Committee. It's, you know, it's here for civil law reasons right now. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, isn't there a civil right of action in this bill? Because if that is the case, could that cause more cases to go to the courts and therefore spur on a fiscal note from the courts?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, the bill gives additional powers to the Attorney General under his statute that does enable a private right of action. As I said in my earlier comments, that's not a new proposal. It's been around many years. We've fiscal noted many years. I don't recall that this committee has ever had to carry a cost for that provision. I don't know why it would be any different this year.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Finally, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, thank you for bringing this bill, and I apologize earlier. I was distracted. Well, what I was, what I was thinking about, and I wanted to thank the gentleman that, testified and spoke about his MS diagnosis. My mother had MS. She passed away young before I graduated from high school. Her treatment was impacted by the cost of the medication. So that's part of my distraction in listening to this conversation here and hearing the testimony from the, gentleman that spoke there. Thank you for bringing this bill. You know, part of it, what we're looking at is how do we ensure that people have access, not because you have wealth, but because treatment is the right thing to do, and do we ensure that you can get that treatment. Other countries are doing this, and in a country with the wealth that we have here, we should be doing it as well. Thank you for bringing this bill.
All right. With that, Representative Stevenson, any closing comments?
In the interest of preserving what limited voice I have, I'll say please vote yes.
All right. I renew my motion that House File 17, as amended, be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. A roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Becker Finn, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Representative Scott.
No.
Scott, no. Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Carroll, aye. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Curran, aye. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Feist, aye. Representative Finke.
Aye.
Finke, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Grossel.
Nope.
Grossel, no. Representative Johnson.
No.
Johnson, no. Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Niska, apologies.
No.
Niska, no. Representative Weens.
No.
Weens, no. Madam Chair, there are 8 ayes and 5 noes.
All right. With 8 ayes and 5 noes, the motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to state and local government. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. It's 9:56. Guys, I did it. We even moved 3 bills. So thank you, everybody, for your attention today. We will be back next week. With that, we are adjourned. Yeah.